This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Trauma Alert is the podcast that brings you current information in the field of trauma and acute care surgery. I'm your host, Trauma Bay. Today we're reviewing burns. Pathophysiology. The mechanisms are thermal or heat, which is the most common, electrical, friction, chemical, and radiation. The skin is the largest organ. It makes up 16% of our body weight, and the functions are to protect the body, protection from infection, temperature changes, physical forces, and chemicals. Severe burns, which are over 20% total body surface area, or TBSA, tend to cause a systemic inflammatory response. There are different zones of a burn injury. The innermost zone is called the zone of coagulation or necrosis, and this has irreversible cell death. The next area is called the zone of ischemia or stasis. This is an area right outside the zone of coagulation, which has decreased circulation and it is threatened. It's at risk of progression to necrosis due to hypoperfusion or infection, and it's analogous to the penumbra in strokes. And then lastly, the outermost area is called the zone of hyperemia, and this is from reversible vasodilation, and it usually returns to normal. In general, burns are dynamic and can progress and worsen over hours to days. Let's first talk about inhalational injury. Inhalational injuries can cause tracheal, bronchial, or lung parenchyma injury. Early intubation is indicated for deep burns to the face or neck, blisters or edema to the oropharynx, stridor, use of accessory muscles, respiratory distress, retractions, or hypoventilation. Treatment for non-intubated patients with inhalational injury is supplemental oxygen with a goal SpO2 over 90%, supervised deep breathing and coughing exercises, turning the patient side to side every 2 hours, chest physical therapy every 2 hours, nebulized treatments every 2 hours, alternating with either aerosolized N-acetylcysteine or bronchodilator with aerosolized heparin or saline, suctioning as needed, and early ambulation. Inhalational injuries essentially burn the airway mucosa and can cause significant edema, sloughing, and pneumonitis. Inhalational injuries are more common when fires occurred in a closed space, such as in a house fire, compared to outdoor fires. With inhalational injury, we need to talk about carbon monoxide poisoning and cyanide poisoning. Carbon monoxide is a colorless, odorless gas with an affinity for hemoglobin 200 times higher than oxygen. Carboxyhemoglobin shifts the hemoglobin-oxygen dissociation curve to the left, impairing the release of oxygen at the tissues. Carbon monoxide poisoning should be suspected in all patients following inhalational injury or house fires until excluded by a normal carboxyhemoglobin level. Remember, the pulse oximetry does not differentiate carboxyhemoglobin from oxyhemoglobin. Carboxyhemoglobin percent levels and their corresponding signs and symptoms. 0 to 10%, none. 10 to 20%, forehead tightness, headache, dilation of cutaneous blood vessels. 20 to 30%, headache, throbbing in the temples. 30 to 40%, severe headache, weakness, dizziness, vision dimness, nausea, vomiting, collapse. 40 to 50%, same as above, and greater possibility of collapse, syncope, increased heart rate, and respiratory rate. 50 to 60% syncope, increased heart rate and respiratory rate, coma, convulsions, chain Stokes respirations. 60 to 70% coma, convulsions, decreased heart rate and respiratory rate, and possible death. 70 to 80% weak pulse, slow respiratory rate, and death within hours. 80 to 90% death in less than 1 hour, and 90 to 100% carboxyhemoglobin level results in death within minutes. A carboxyhemoglobin level over 3% is considered abnormal in non-smokers, and over 10% is abnormal in smokers. The workup also includes checking the acid-base status, an EKG, and cardiac biomarkers. Treatment of carbon monoxide poisoning. Patients are initially placed on high-flow, normobaric, 100% supplemental oxygen until they are symptom-free, usually for about 4 to 5 hours. The elimination of carbon monoxide starts once the patient is removed from the exposure, and it's almost exclusively via pulmonary circulation through competitive binding of hemoglobin by oxygen. The half-life of carboxyhemoglobin in a patient on Remare is about 250 to 320 minutes, but this decreases to 75 to 90 minutes with high-flow oxygen, over 15 liters a minute, via a non-rebreather. Indications for hyperbaric oxygen are a carboxyhemoglobin level over 25% or over 15% if the patient is pregnant, unconscious at the scene or hospital, reported syncope, persistent coma, altered mental status, focal neurodeficit, severe acidosis with a pH of less than 7.25 after empiric cyanide treatment if administered, and evidence of end organ ischemia such as EKG changes, elevated cardiac biomarkers, respiratory failure, focal neurodeficit, altered mental status. Carboxyhemoglobin levels do not always correlate with the initial severity of poisoning, especially if time has passed since exposure and there is physiologic clearance of carbon monoxide. If there is an abnormal carboxyhemoglobin with major symptoms, that is still considered significant poisoning. The goal of hyperbaric oxygen is not just to increase clearance of carbon monoxide, but also prevent delayed neuropsychiatric syndrome, which are late deficits associated with severe carbon monoxide poisoning. In patients with smoke inhalation who have altered mental status, metabolic acidosis, or hemodynamic instability, they should get concurrent empiric treatment for cyanide poisoning. Don't get carboxyhemoglobin confused with methemoglobin. Methemoglobinemia is a completely different condition where there's also decreased oxygen carrying capacity of the hemoglobin, but it's due to conversion of some or all of the iron from the reduced or ferrous or Fe2+ state to the oxidized or ferric or Fe3+ state. Ferric, or Fe3+, is unable to bind and transport oxygen, resulting in a functional anemia and refractory hypoxemia. It can be congenital or acquired. Acquired methemoglobinemia is typically due to medications or toxins, for example, the medication benzocaine. Methemoglobinemia is treated with methylene blue, which reduces the methemoglobin to hemoglobin. Okay, I know that was a major sidetrack, but just don't mix up carboxyhemoglobin with methemoglobin. Also, sidetrack on sidetrack, why is methylene blue so nifty? It can be used to treat malaria in cases of resistance to the typical medications, and it can be used as a pressor in vasoplegic or distributive shock, and there's several other uses. Now, cyanide poisoning. Hydrogen cyanide is the gas form of cyanide. It's a colorless gas with the odor of bitter almonds. Cyanide poisoning is difficult to diagnose in the immediate post-injury phase because symptoms are nonspecific and cyanide levels cannot be measured soon enough to be clinically meaningful. Cyanide toxicity should be considered in every patient with inhalational injury. Treatment with hydroxycobalamin is indicated for those with a decreased level of consciousness, cardiac arrest, or cardiac decompensation, even in the absence of lab confirmation. Hydroxycobalamin is a precursor to methylcobalamin and adenosylcobalamin, which are the active forms of vitamin B12. So hydroxycobalamin is also used for vitamin B12 deficiency. In high doses, it is an effective chelator of cyanide. It is the preferred antidote to cyanide poisoning due to its low side effect profile. Hydroxycobalamin rapidly forms cyanocobalamin by removing the cyanide from the tissues. The kidneys then excrete the cyanocobalamin in the urine. Hydroxycobalamin is given 5 grams IV for adults or 70 milligrams per kilo for pediatrics with a max of 5 grams. If it's not available and there's no contraindication to nitrites, you can give sodium nitrite at 3% in 10 milliliters IV at 2.5 to 5 milliliters per minute, and you can repeat that once. If hydroxycobalamin is not available and nitrites are contraindicated, you can give sodium thiosulfate 25% in 50 mils IV for a total of 12.5 grams, and you can repeat that once. Okay, now let's talk about estimating the total body surface area of burns. Remember to only use partial and full thickness burns in the estimation. Do not include superficial burns. The rule of nines is the fastest method, but a little less accurate. In adults, the entire head is 9%, anterior 4.5%, and posterior 4.5%. The entire trunk is 36%, or the anterior torso is 18%, and the posterior torso is 18%. Within that, the anterior chest is 9%, and the anterior abdomen is 9%, and same for posterior chest and abdomen. The upper extremity is 9% each, or 18% for bilateral upper extremities. Within the upper extremity, 4.5% is anterior and 4.5% is posterior. The lower extremity is twice as much. Each lower extremity is 18%, or 36% for bilateral lower extremities. So the anterior lower extremity is 9% and the posterior lower extremity is 9%, and then the groin is 1%. The Lund-Brouwer method is the most accurate, but it's not as easy to remember, so you should probably save a photo of the chart for quick reference. It's especially accurate for children since they have larger heads and smaller extremities. Per the Lund-Brauer chart, in adults, the head is 4.5%, the neck is 1%, the trunk is 13%, the upper arm is 2%, the forearm is 1.5%, the hand is 1.25%, the thigh is 4.5%, leg 3.25%, foot 1.75%, buttock 2.5%, and genitalia 1%. Also, all those numbers except buttock and genitalia are only for an anterior portion or the posterior portion, but not both. And lastly, there's the palm method. This is better for small or really patchy burns, and you use the patient's palm size. So the palm of the hand without the fingers is 0.5%, and the palm of the hand with the fingers is 1%. Now let's talk about burn depth. Burn wounds are usually not one uniform depth. What was used to be called first degree is now superficial. Second degree is now just called partial thickness. Third degree is full thickness. And fourth degree is deep tissue burns. So superficial burns only involve the epidermis. They're painful, red, dry. There's no blisters, and they're essentially a sunburn. Partial thickness has superficial partial thickness and deep partial thickness. Superficial partial thickness extends to the superficial dermis. They typically form blisters within 24 hours between the epidermis and dermis. They are very painful, red, they weep, they blanch with pressure, and they typically heal in 7 to 21 days without significant scarring. Deep partial thickness burns extend into the deeper dermis. They damage hair follicles and glands. They're only painful to pressure. They almost always blister. They are wet or waxy dry with a variable mottled color. Blanching may be sluggish, and they could heal in 2 to 9 weeks without grafting, but they always cause hypertrophic scarring. Full thickness burns extend through all layers of the dermis and often injure subcutaneous fat also. The burn eschar is often intact. It's usually anesthetic or hypoesthetic. It can appear waxy white to gray or even black. The skin is dry and does not blanch with pressure. There are no blisters, and without surgery, they would only heal by contracture with severe scarring. And then deep tissue burns extend to underlying muscle or bone and are often life-threatening. Now let's talk about burn management. For initial wound care, the burns should only be cleaned with gentle soap and water initially. The use of disinfectants such as Hibiclens and Betadine can actually decrease wound healing. Tar can be emulsified with a mineral oil cool water mixture. Debris or clothing should only be removed with irrigation. And then after the burn wound is cleaned, a thin layer of a topical antibiotic ointment and nonstick gauze can be applied. Fluid resuscitation. Burn shock is inadequate perfusion due to inflammatory myocardial depression and capillary leak. The main goal of resuscitation of burn patients is a urine output of 0.5 cc per kilogram per hour. In adults, that's about 30 to 50 milliliters. And in general, the IV fluid rate is adjusted to meet the urine output goal. LR is the fluid of choice. The modified Brook formula is 2 milliliters per kilogram per percent TBSA for 24 hours, with the first half given over 8 hours and the second half given over the next 16 hours. The Parkland formula is 4 milliliters per kilogram per percent TBSA for 24 hours, half over 8 hours, and half over 16 hours. The updated ABA guidelines recommend starting with the 2 milliliter per kilo per TBSA formula and then titrating by the urine output goal. Okay, let's talk about escharotomy. Escharotomy may be needed for circumferential full thickness burns on extremities with signs of distal ischemia, or for torso burns if it is limiting the tidal volume or causing hypoventilation. Constrictive swelling leading to ischemia from the eschar typically only happens after about 3 to 4 hours of fluid resuscitation. For escharotomy incisions, looking at a picture definitely helps, but for the chest escharotomy, it's basically 3 big incisions. There are 2 large vertical incisions going from the clavicle all the way to the inferior portion of the costal margin, just lateral to the nipples. Then those 2 incisions are connected by a transverse incision, which is over the inferior chest and upper abdomen around the midpoint of the costal margins. Remember, escharotomy is just a skin incision. You're incising the eschar, or the burned skin, all the way down to subcutaneous fat. So this is not a fasciotomy. Those are different. GI considerations. Shock can lead to mesenteric vasoconstriction, which predisposes to gastric distension, a curling ulcer, and aspiration. An NG tube should be placed in patients with over 20% TBSA burns, and early enteral feedings within 24 hours of injury attenuate the catabolic response and are associated with improved outcomes. Lastly, let's talk about metabolic dysfunction. Burn patients have a hypermetabolic state that is associated with immunosuppression, impaired wound healing, muscle catabolism, and hepatic dysfunction. It's characterized by increased blood pressure and increased heart rate, peripheral insulin resistance, increased protein and lipid catabolism, increased resting energy expenditure, increased body temperature, total body protein loss, muscle wasting, and stimulated synthesis of acute phase proteins. While this response occurs in all trauma, surgical, or critically ill patients, the magnitude and duration are particularly severe and sustained for burn patients. The metabolic dysfunction actually has an initial ebb phase, which occurs within the first 48 hours. It's characterized by decreased cardiac output, oxygen consumption, metabolic rate, and impaired glucose tolerance and hyperglycemia. Then there's a flow phase where there's a gradual increase in metabolism to reach a plateau within the first 5 days post-injury and is associated with hyperdynamic circulation and development of insulin resistance. Metabolic dysfunction can even last for more than 12 months after the initial event and does not necessarily resolve completely after wound closure. Impaired glucose metabolism and insulin sensitivity can persist for up to 3 years after severe burn injury. Early burn excision and grafting are associated with a reduction in metabolic parameters, but wound closure alone does not eliminate the hypermetabolic response. Early excision and grafting are also associated with a decreased severity of hypertrophic scarring, joint contracture, and stiffness, and they promote faster rehabilitation. And that's it for today's episode on burns.